Welcome to the RepChat Inside Stories series, conversations with creative talent and creative entrepreneurial businesses. We discover the inside stories that inspire and motivate creative people to do what they do.
Dark Dante by Maggie Rose. Dark Dante unfolds in Florence in the spring of 2000, exactly 700 years after Dante Alighieri set his Inferno there. Disgusted with the corruption of his contemporaries, the poet decides to punish the ill-doers of the day in his magnificent poem. In this engaging and evocative mystery thriller, a string of horrendous murders is committed in quick succession. Seeing that the Italian police are making little headway finding the culprit, Maria Farrell, the niece of the first victim, Peter Farrell, decides to investigate. Because of a family feud, she never met Peter, a specialist in art history, who lived in Florence most of his life. Maria, a theatre director from Manchester, shrewdly exploits her professional skills and knowledge of Shakespeare's theatre in her attempt to solve the murders. Caught in a web of mystery and grappling to understand the mindset of the Italians she encounters, this unusual detective follows the Dante trail, in the conviction that somebody in Florence, obsessed by Dante, may have decided to mete out the punishments described in the Inferno all those centuries before. Maria's investigation reveals much about her uncle Peter and the fascinating medley of friends in his inner circle. And importantly, a growing friendship with one of the detectives on the murder case leads Maria to reconsider her priorities in life. About to leave England, she resolves to return to Florence very soon to see her new friend and hopefully discover more about the enigmatic figure of Dark Dante. Hello, this is Rebecca Dixon, and we warmly welcome Maggie Rose to the RepChat Inside Stories. Dark Dante is her first novel, but she has been writing for a great part of her life. As a playwright, she's also a teacher and a workshop leader, among other things. Her work has been published and performed in both Italy and Scotland, and it's so nice to have you here with us today, Maggie.
Thank you so much, Rebecca, for inviting me. I'm very happy to be able to talk about this debut novel. Thank you.
So you live in Milan, Maggie, and you're exceptionally passionate about literature and theatre. You have had work, you've worked on so many amazing projects during your career, radio plays, participating often in the Edinburgh Festival. Maybe you could tell us a little bit more about yourself.
I think, you know, it sounds as though by what you say, I've been doing a lot of things, but certainly I think theatre throughout my life has been my great passion, because it's allowed me to meet people from all walks of life, you know, both through my writing, my research, the work theatre workshops and so on. And at the moment, I'm particularly passionate about a project I'm doing in Milan. I've been doing it since 2015 with some colleagues of mine, that we take Shakespeare into the juvenile detention centre in Milan, the Cesare Beccaria. And that's very interesting, you know, because you're working with young minors who have got serious problems often. But when you do theatre, you realise that we're all, you know, very similar in many ways. You get over a lot of hurdles.
Indeed, indeed. And I actually noticed that this morning on your website and was going to ask you about that. So you've actually anticipated my question there. Dark Dante, Maggie, I read every single word. There was no skimming. From your book, it's very clear that you know Florence, the Italian lifestyle and Italian language very well. In your narrative, you describe the buildings, monuments and gardens in fine, poetic and accurate detail. What is your connection to Florence?
Well, my connection to Florence goes far further back than the actual novel, which I published obviously this year. It actually started when I was a student in, or just finished my degree in the early 70s. And I started going to Florence to visit it. Then I made friends with Florentines. And I've been back on many occasions for conferences. Mm-hmm. So it's been a continual, you know, discovery of this city, which is just, you know, like, as you know, Rebecca, mm. Italian Renaissance cities are full of secrets and mysteries. Indeed. And if you've got a curious mind, you never, you know, you never get bored. Every time you go back, you discover something else.
That is totally true. I find that with Venice a lot, that every time I go back, I get more and more awestruck by this city, that maybe the first time you can't take it all in. What inspired you to write Dark Dante?
I think it was at a certain point in my life, about 15 years ago or so, I decided I had to become more familiar with Italian literature, because, I mean, I've been teaching British theatre studies mm-hmm. for most of my career. So I started reading some classical works, and one of them was The Inferno, and I was absolutely blown away by it. I mean, there's no other word. Mm. I think it's just incredible, the graphic images that Dante gives you, and the analysis he makes of the human mind, you know, mm. of evil, of people who are deserving his way of looking at things, punishment. But there's mm. this great design within this epic poem mm-hmm. that is, it is, it's just mind-blowing.
Very, very interesting. You also mentioned something about the fact that Italians study much more literature outside their own home country than we Brits. Is that true?
That, I think, is absolutely true. I mean, you know, I speak to my nephews today, and they know nothing about Dante or Pasolini mm. and so on. They know a lot about Shakespeare. So it's very, very still, the syllabus in Britain is very focused on our own authors. I mean, we've got great authors. I've nothing to say again, but, you know, absolutely first rate. Exactly. But it seems to me it's a very closed way of looking at literature. So when I wrote Dark Dante, I had in mind, you know, all those people in the English-speaking world, I'm sure uh-huh. it's the same thing in Australia and New Zealand, who know nothing about Dante. So I thought this novel, apart from being, I hope at least, a good mystery thriller, it also is a way for people who know nothing about Dante or very little about Dante to learn, you know, the way he saw the world and the hopes he had to change things.
Indeed, and you made a very good job of that. I learned a lot through reading Dark Dante. Let's talk about the characters, Maggie, in particular Maria Farrell. The story is told through her in first person. And I wonder about Maria. As I was reading it, is there a connection to Maria and your own background?
Well, I suppose people say with all first novels is a lot of autobiography. I suppose mm-hmm. I've fallen into what is, in a way, a trap, or it might not be a trap, I don't know. Certainly, I think, you know, I didn't think about it while I was writing it, because I just got on with it and wrote it. I didn't want to analyse what I was writing as I was in the process. But looking back with hindsight, probably Maria is a kind of figure that I imagine would have been myself had I not moved to Italy. If I'd stayed in Manchester, because I mean, my aim before I moved to Italy was actually to work in and make documentaries at Granada. That was my great aspiration when I was, you know, in my late teens. So I suppose Maria, does fulfill that wish. And then Maria as well, like myself, is an expert on Shakespeare mm-hmm. and so on. But then there are lots of different things, you know, that I certainly am not Maria. And I think that's true of her and also the other characters. There are bits and bobs of myself in all of them.
Yeah, indeed. She's very complete though, and at times she's actually very amusing. She's a great young woman from Manchester. The other characters, the twins, the investigators, Katerina Singh, Gabriele, I suppose they are all based too, like you just said, on people that you have met, characters you have known, and you've probably just taken a bit from one person, taken a bit from somebody else.
Yeah, I think that happens. I mean, even when I write plays, this has happened in the past. But I think there, as an author, you're very conscious that you don't want to put a person that you know in a novel. You know, it would be, you know, embarrassing or difficult for copyright and so on. So what happens is there are little bits of certain people that perhaps even unconsciously you put in the book, and then you only see it later, or somebody else points it out to you later that there's a bit of somebody in a book. But then in the end, it's your imagination that takes off. You know, there might be that snippet of reality blown up into a fully fledged character. I think that's the joy of writing, isn't it? Creative writing.
Indeed, indeed it is. And we write about what we know, don't we? We always write about what we know. So who we know is going to be part of that too. I'd like to talk a little bit also about your style of writing. It's wonderful. It's very rich. It's really detailed, but it never becomes tedious, Maggie. It's very easy to picture the people and the places you describe. I think we can read some lines from chapter 50 when you describe Juliana, a dressmaker. Once Katerina has opened the door leading to the dressmaker's atelier, we climb to the second floor where Juliana greets us and shows us inside. In her late 40s, she is slim, her hair cropped short with a fringe. She is dressed simply in a navy blue cotton tube dress. Her only accessories, a necklace of exquisite pearls, a small silver watch, and a tape measure slung around her neck. "Isn't she just the spitting image of Coco Chanel?" Katerina whispers. "Such exquisite taste." Once Katerina has said hello, she introduces me. "Signora Nespi, I brought my friend Maria for a new outfit. She's returning to England next week and needs something fabulous. A linen two-piece, perhaps?" I look around the room. Rolls of fabric are stacked on shelves on every wall, with a huge cutting table in the centre. To the left, another room, whose door is open, reveals a row of sewing machines where some women are making garments. So we can really picture this Italian dressmaker and her setting. And Juliana appears very, very briefly. And even there, you've taken great care to help the reader understand who Juliana is. And I really appreciated that in your book, Maggie. You obviously also have an interest in the criminal mind and you like mystery. Can you talk to us about this?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, I suppose my interest in the criminal mind was triggered by Shakespeare, by Shakespeare's villains. I mean, when you take characters like Richard III or Iago, you've certainly got Shakespeare going into the realm of, you know, evil and what makes people evil, and the impossibility often for an author, either a dramatist or a novelist, to understand the criminal mind, as you call it, Rebecca. I mean, Iago says, "I am what I am, and you're never going to find out anymore." So, you know, there have been hundreds of books written on Othello, but we're never going to get to the bottom of what Iago is really about. And yeah, that fascination with evil, certainly, you know, I more than read crime novels. I actually watch a lot of telly, documentaries, any kind of reports about murders and so on. I admit I have got this fascination. And this also dates back to, I don't know, when I think about the Moors murderers when I was a teenager, you know, Ian Brady and Myra Hindley. I remember being really, really struck by that and wanted to know all about it. And that has continued. So, yeah, I must say I find the criminal mind much more fascinating than, say, good people. You know, I never really get to the bottom of it, so I continue my investigation constantly.
I think on that, I think we probably all do. We're all quite fascinated by people who are murderers and what takes them to that point of taking somebody else's life. You used a very clever technique to describe the murders. It was no longer from Maria's personal narration, but instead it was described in the third person as a kind of narrator, which was very effective. Maybe here yet again, we can read an excerpt from chapter 32 as an example. She was drifting off to sleep when she heard a knock on the door. Hearing the voice of the man she'd sent packing the night before, she dragged herself out of bed, still heavy with sleep. She opened the door, half presuming he'd come to apologise. But the moment their eyes met, he grabbed her, stuffing a cloth in her mouth to stop her screaming. Propelling her into the bedroom, he pushed her down onto the bed. His hand searched for her throat, then his grip tightened until she lost consciousness, after which he hit her with a hammer. A single blow, and he had cracked Doris's skull. Brilliant, Maggie. Brilliant. This technique, from changing from the first person to the third person, it created suspense and credibility. It was a great choice. How did you get this idea?
Yeah, well, I started off writing the novel in the first person through Maria. So Maria, as you said, Becky, before, is a person who arrives in Florence. She doesn't know Florence well. And it became clear to me very soon through this first person narration that certain things couldn't be told by Maria. You know, I needed a third person narrator, somebody who was well acquainted with Florence, somebody who was acquainted with the judicial system and so on. So it was almost a compulsory thing, this, to have the two narrators. At the same time, for me as a dramatist, it's much easier to write in the first person. That's what I'm used to doing. So I was able to use my expertise in that area. But at the same time, in the end, I did, as you say, use this third person.
Very, very well done. So apart from the tours around Florence and Tuscany, whilst we read your book, I think one of my favourite passages is when Maria discovers that she has an enemy who she thought was a friend. It was in, was it Gabriele?
Gabriele.
Yeah, and it was great. That was a great part. It made me laugh because there was all this Italian fire going on. There was plates going all over the place. And, you know, I could see it all. We won't talk much more about that because we don't want to spoil it for our readers. But it was brilliant, brilliant. We can see your Dark Dante as a film.
Yes, somebody else has said this. Yeah, I mean, I would love it to become a film. It would be fantastic. And also it would have these incredibly good locations, wouldn't it? And the lesser known places as well, some of them, aren't they?
Indeed. Yeah. Who do you see as your readers?
As I was writing, I mean, I think it's Virginia Woolf talks about your ideal reader. It was somebody in the English speaking world. You know, I thought, well, I'll write this novel. It's not for Italians because I'm not Italian. How on earth can I write a novel about Dante if I'm not Italian? But I mean, lots of people have done that. But in my mind, there was this thing that I told you about before. I wanted it to, in a way, to popularize Dante in the English-speaking world. But I mean, now Italian friends have actually read the book and they've liked it. So, you know, at a certain point, I suppose it won't be for Dante academics because it isn't, you know, an erudite book about, you know, very specific things in Dante. But I think, yeah, it can be read by all sorts of people all over the place.
Indeed. Another curiosity, Maggie, is how long did you work on Dark Dante? There's a lot of research there. How long did it take you?
Yeah, it must have been about 10 years, absolutely on and off. I would go back to Florence and look at different places, because everywhere I describe in the novel, I've actually been and done research. Sometimes I went on my own. Other times I asked Tuscan friends to go with me. Once, historians, or a friend of mine who's a sommelier who knows all about the restaurants and so on in Florence. And she also told me a lot about fashion in Florence. So there was a great variety of people who fed information into it. And then, of course, I had these masses of information which I had to filter, and I used certain things rather than others. But I must say the photographs I took were very useful, because, I could go back to them and look at certain details. Mm. And the other day I was looking at them and thinking, when I do a presentation, hopefully I'll be doing a presentation in Edinburgh in spring, I'll use certain photographs as well to present the novel.
In any case, a lot of work and a great chunk of your life has been put into Dark Dante.
Yeah.
What do you value most about this work in Dark Dante, if that's not a difficult question?
Well, no, I think the value for me personally is this new adventure, of being a novelist and moving into circles I'd never moved in before. Because when you write for the theatre, you're part of a creative team. I never think of myself alone when I'm writing plays, because I'm immediately working with a director, a costume designer, blah, blah, blah. Mm. Whereas with a novel, you are actually on your own. And the way you're promoting this as well is different. So it's a whole new strategy for me.
Ah, that's interesting. So that was your challenge also, to work on your own. I hadn't thought about that aspect of it, becoming a lone ranger rather than a
team.
So I'm going to ask you now, is what do you think is Dante's relevance in the modern age?
Yeah, I think, he's got a lot of, obviously, there being a huge worldwide writer and incredibly talented, I think I can just say for me what he means. And it's certainly the fact that he was a great writer, but also a person with this huge civic consciousness. He was a top politician before he was sent into exile. Mm-hmm. As a young man, he'd already, obviously, then, he died a lot earlier than you do today. So by the time he was 30, he was a priore in Florence. So with a huge responsibility. Mm-hmm. And to mix these two things, it was pretty normal at the time, and it went on in the Renaissance that people had different specializations. But I think it's a thing we could go back to today. The fact that many of our politicians aren't highly or deeply cultivated people.
indeed. We both live in Italy.
We'd benefit a lot, wouldn't we, if they did have this mix. It would be good for everybody, I think.
Maggie, you have many other talents too. You're a co-founder of the English Theatre in Milan. Would you like to tell us something about this, your theatre group?
Yes, no, it's really amazingly successful, this association. Even if we had lockdown, we only had two or three plays before we actually, before lockdown happened. We founded it in 2019. So what has happened over the last 2 years is that English Theatre Milan has been working online, but we've continued, we had two major productions online. We went to the Edinburgh Fringe this summer online with this Victorian farce, Box and Cox. And there's a lot of interest in it, from people, not just in Milan, but in Lombardy and around the world through the online productions. So it is this again is a relatively new thing for me, but I really do believe that in Milan there is a need for an English-speaking theatre, you know, with the huge international population we have. It's apparent it could grow a lot, but we're looking as well for people, and this I hope if anybody hears this, for people who are qualified actors, who are native speakers or with very good English, it would be good to contact more people. We've already got a group, but this could well expand.
So you're looking for people to join you. And as you said, Milan is a very cosmopolitan city. And online, during the pandemic, it's interesting how the theatre managed to reach out internationally too. Doors were opened rather than doors were closed to some extent.
Well, absolutely. I mean, we had people, top professionals working with us during lockdown, you know, people who normally would never have been working for free, because we all work for free because we just wanted to keep on working, which was, you know, it was a fabulous experience. And yes. I think it was probably a one-off experience, because in the future, you know, these people are back on the stage now. But, totally. It, you know, out of everything, you know, even if there's a huge crisis as there was with the pandemic, there were these really positive things happening.
Totally, totally agree with that, Maggie. Yeah. So thank you so much for talking to us today. If people want to know more about Maggie Rose, the English Theatre, they can go to the Facebook, I think, at English Theatre Milan Teatro di Performance d'Arte. Is that right?
Yes, or they can, we've got a website which is info@englishtheatremilan.org.
And where can people find your book?
People can find my book most easily on Amazon. Mm-hmm. It's on Amazon, both Italy Amazon and the UK Amazon. That's the easiest way. And it's both paperback and ebook.
Exactly. There's an e version of it too, which I noticed.
Yes.
Okay, Maggie, thank you so much for talking to us on the Reb Chat Inside Stories. We'll say goodbye to you and we will keep in touch. And I thoroughly invite our listeners to read The Dark Dante. Thank you, Maggie.
Thank you, Rebecca. Thanks so much for inviting me.
Thanks for listening to the Reb Chat Inside Stories series. We hope you enjoyed it. To feature your inside story, contact us at www.rebcatcreations.com or follow us on Instagram at Reb Chat Creations.